Become a sponsor today by visiting patreon.com/psychologyis.
Welcome and thank you so much for tuning into the Psychology Is podcast. This is our 59th episode. I'm your host, Nick Fortino. And today I have with me Dr. Patrick Hahn, who is a science writer and author of many books and expert in biology. And I'll let you elaborate on your background, but I'll just say for the audience that you have a great website, patrickhahn.net. We'll make sure we provide links. And books you've written most recently include The Day Science Died and Prescription for Sorrow, Antidepressant Suicide and Violence, Madness and Genetic Determinism. And then, of course, Obedience Pills, ADHD and the Medicalization of Childhood. This is the one of yours that I've read, and I think very highly of it. And many of our subscribers, our audience members, you know, have been following this podcast for a while. And so you're aware that I've spoken to many experts who have valid criticisms of psychiatry and modern day paradigms around various behaviors and emotional patterns and thought patterns. So, you know, the audience knows that I've been reading many books on this topic, but yours really is outstanding. I think you did a great job. So congratulations with that. And can you just elaborate, introduce yourself a little bit more, tell us about your educational background, your professional activities, and what led you to want to, you know, what drew your interest in this topic?
Hey, well, my background is not in medicine or psychiatry or psychology. I am a university teacher by profession. I have spent my entire career working to make scientific knowledge available to all. And I view my work as an author as an extension of that. I've never claimed my degree gives me any authority in these matters, but it has given me a perspective, which I believe is undervalued. My background is in evolutionary biology. And two things have long been obvious to me. One is that our bodies evolved to function, and to function very well. They did not evolve to malfunction. And the second is that our bodies evolved to function for a time, and then to die and get the hell out of the way of the next generation. And I have long been skeptical of much of what the medical profession does. And in midlife, I became aware of some capacities that were going unused. And at the preposterously advanced age of 51, I enrolled in the science writing program at the Johns Hopkins University at the even more preposterously advanced age of 54, I walked across the stage and collected my second master's degree. And I published 4 books in 4 years. And I knew I wanted to write about over-medicalization, not specifically psychiatry. But if you wish to write about over-medicalization, psychiatry provides an endless vein of material. I've come to the conclusion that psychiatry is a pseudoscience. The world would be better off without it.
100%. It is the lowest hanging fruit if you're looking for something to criticize about modern day medicine.
The problems they treat manifestly are not medical problems. Right. They're not amenable to medical solutions. And so I continued with this theme in my book, Obedience Pills. The doctors who purport to treat this condition have never been able to agree on very much about this condition, starting with what to call it, minimal brain dysfunction, hyperkinetic reaction of childhood, minimal brain damage, and attention deficit disorder, and a whole slew of other names, and most recently, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. That category has been around only since 1980, since the DSM-3 kicked off the era of biological psychiatry. But there are clinical accounts of children who today are said to have suffered from this disorder going back well over a century. And the first such account was published by George Still all the way back in 1903. Still was the founding father of pediatric medicine, by the way. And his account described 20 children, 15 boys and 5 girls, whom he said were suffering from a lack of moral control. And in reading Dr. Still's account, one thing is for certain. This was a bunch of seriously messed up kids who lied, stole, spat on people, destroyed property, viciously touched other children sexually, viciously attacked other children and even adults, tortured animals, set fires, so on and so forth. Another thing that is obvious is that these seriously disturbed children came from seriously disturbed families, rife with tales of illness, alcoholism, abuse, abandonment. In one of these families, the child's father had murdered his mother. And Dr. Still gave no consideration to the possibility that these children's problems might stem from their disordered upbringing. Rather, he took the family problems as proof that these children came from inferior genetic stock. And
genetics.
Yeah. The first, the use of stimulant drugs to treat this ill-defined syndrome goes all the way back to the 1930s. A fellow named Charles Bradley, he worked at the Bradley Home for Children in Rhode Island. For the record, the Bradley Home was founded by a cousin of Charles Bradley, who named it after his own daughter, who died of encephalitis at the age of 27. But anyway, Dr. Bradley was interested in a technique called pneumoencephalography. And that's when they withdraw a quantity of cerebrospinal fluid from the spinal canal and replace it with air. So to make a better contrast for showing up on x-rays. And so the child would be strapped down in this rotating chair. And after enduring a painful lumbar puncture, the chair would be rotated in various directions in a specified sequence, so the air bubble could displace the cerebrospinal fluid in the brain. And a big surprise, this procedure caused dizziness, vertigo, nausea, severe headaches. It could take weeks for the normal amount of cerebrospinal fluid to regenerate. And Dr. Bradley became concerned about the misery that this procedure was inflicting upon his young charges. Not concerned enough to stop doing it, but concerned nonetheless. And the drug amphetamine had come onto the market just 5 years before. And so he tested this drug on the children. And he found that it did nothing for their headaches. But what it did do, and this is, of course, a well-known effect of amphetamine, it blunts their affect, increases children's ability to concentrate on, and adults, anyone's ability to concentrate on boring tasks. In short, it creates the kind of changes in children which an exhausted parent or a harried school teacher would likely regard as improvements. Mm-hmm. And what about Dr. Bradley's studies of the brains of these children that caused so much misery to his young charges? They yielded no findings that were of any use to science whatsoever.
Thank you for that. And many people listening probably are aware of the historical context. In the 1930s was when frontal lobotomies were happening and asylums were decrepit, disgusting places that would turn anybody psychotic if they had to stay there. And there was still, you know, beliefs in trepanation and near drowning therapy and extended bath therapy and organ removal and just all of the most horrific, torturous, inhumane, so-called treatments you could imagine. And this to me really, really highlights something important, which is that despite the fact that there are many people today who I respect, who are very intelligent, who work as psychiatrists, the field of psychiatry has been defined by crises of legitimacy throughout time. It has always been an outcast in the field of medicine. The field has always been desperately attempting to make itself sound and seem and be as scientific as other medical fields, but it never has been, and it never will be, in my opinion. Understanding human behavior and what shapes human perception, human emotion, thoughts, is the realm of psychology. And what is going on a biological level, on a neurological level, is the realm of neurology. And psychiatry sits in this strange middle ground between the two, but it's not the best of both worlds by any means. It's this a scientifically empty, you know, medical field that is doing harm. And sometimes when I hear myself say things like this, I'm a very reasonable, rational person. And I always think, am I exaggerating? Am I being hyperbolic? But honestly, when I then go back and sometimes rewatch these podcasts or just reflect on the things that I'm saying, I actually end up with the conclusion, I don't think I'm speaking passionately enough. I think that what is happening in the realm of psychiatry right now, what is happening with the drugging of children is a crime against humanity that we will look back upon shamefully. And it's I have a sense that it's getting better, but that might be only because of the world that I'm in and my social network and the experts that I'm talking to. I don't know whether the data bear out this notion that things are getting better. So just to kind of justify, you know, everything I've just said, let's talk about the diagnosis of ADHD and the problems, the nature of that diagnosis, the problems with it, and the implications of diagnosing somebody with ADHD. So what would you like to share about the nature of the diagnosis of ADHD?
Well, we spent billions of dollars on genetics studies. There's no gene for ADHD. There is no, and billions of dollars on neuroimaging studies. There is no abnormality of brain structure, which is diagnostic of ADHD. There is no abnormality of brain function that is diagnostic of ADHD. This condition, and I, as I've said, it's been referred to by a long number of names over the year, large number of names over the years, is defined just by symptom checklists. These long lists of checklists, some of which are mutually exclusive. Talks too much, too shy, too bossy, too gullible. The child can, in fact, a hyperactive child doesn't even have to be hyperactive. According to Paul Wender, who was styled as the dean of ADHD, one of the symptoms of quote unquote hyperactivity is extreme sluggishness. And you look at the definition, the current definition, ADHD, I mean, these quote unquote symptoms are absolutely ridiculous. One of them I mentioned in my book, unable to play or engage in leisure activities quietly. Guess what? Children do not play quietly. They chatter incessantly. They yell and scream and laugh. That's part of being a kid. It makes me wonder if the doctors who come up with these checklists ever had children or ever were children. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And if I may read something you wrote when you were talking about this in your book. So this is in, let me see exactly which chapter it is in. It's the chapter Hyperactivity Becomes ADHD. And you wrote, upon inspection, it becomes obvious that these, quote, symptoms are hopelessly subjective and context dependent. Every one of them is qualified by often, raising the obvious question, how often is too often? It seems obvious that a diagnosis of ADHD will depend at least as much on the time and patience and energy of a child's that a child's caregivers have as on any intrinsic qualities of the child, which is such an important point that I feel like I haven't quite heard people make as much. And that is, we're saying often, right? The word often is a subjective word. What one person thinks of as often is different than what another person will think of as often, which means that a person can have ADHD in the eyes of one perceiver, but not in the eyes of another perceiver. And it's true. I just turned my window to the DSM-5, which I keep open on my computer. And yeah, every single symptom starts with the word often. And some of them are, for example, here's one of the symptoms of the hyperactivity and impulsivity feature of ADHD. It's a quote, is often on the go, acting as if driven by a motor. That's absurd. That's an absurd symptom to cloak as a medical diagnosis. And if I may add too, this is something that Dr. Sam Tamimi really helped me understand more clearly, and I'm sure you understand it well already, that these, we call this, the DSM is the Diagnostic Statistical Manual. And when people are diagnosed with a mental disorder, they are, you know, they're not, the fact is they're not actually being diagnosed with anything, because the technical definition of a medical diagnosis is the process of determining which disease or condition explains a person's symptoms. No condition in the DSM explains the symptoms. It only lists the symptoms. And this is so crucial for people to understand because of many reasons. It has many implications, but it would be, so what we're saying is that if you are coughing and you can't stop coughing, and so you go and you see a doctor, the diagnosis will likely be something like maybe bronchitis, because bronchitis is a virus that explains why you're coughing. But what happens, the equivalent of a diagnosis of a mental disorder would be if you were coughing and you went to see a doctor and the doctor says, you're coughing because you're coughing. You're coughing because you have coughing disorder. This does not explain anything. When a parent has a child exhibiting problematic behaviors and they take that child to a psychiatrist and the psychiatrist says, oh, it's because the child has ADHD, the parent thinks that they have an explanation now, but they do not. All the psychiatrist said was, your child has problematic behaviors. And the reason, and sorry, I know I'm kind of hogging the mic here, and I want this to be me giving you the mic, but if I may just say one more thing, one of the reasons this is so problematic is because it stops us from searching for the real cause, if there is even one at all, right? And so on this note, I wanted to read a great quote that you wrote right around the same spot in your book. You quote Dr. Richard Saul, who is a neurologist. I'm sure you remember writing this. And in an essay he wrote called ADHD Does Not Exist, he sums it up and he says, in my view, there are two types of people who are diagnosed with ADHD. Those who exhibit a normal level of distraction and impulsiveness, and those who have another condition or disorder that requires individual treatment. He goes on to say, for my patients who are in the first category, I recommend that they eat right, exercise more often, get 8 hours of quality sleep a night, minimize caffeine intake in the afternoon, monitor their cell phone use while they're working, and more important, do something they're passionate about. For my second group of patients with severe attention issues, I require a full evaluation to find the source of the problem. Usually, once the original condition is found and treated, the ADHD symptoms go away. And he's pointing out that, as you say, you know, the diagnostic criteria in the DSM-5 are so vague and subjective that the entire U.S. population could potentially qualify, and that there are over 20 medical conditions that can cause symptoms of ADHD, including sleep disorders, undiagnosed vision and hearing problems, substance abuse, iron deficiency, allergies, and many others. And so perhaps one of the worst implications of all of this, besides the way that it just distorts a person's self-concept and locks them into a fixed mindset about their abilities, is that what if they have an iron deficiency? And now they think they found the source of their problem, but they haven't. And so they stop searching, and they never reveal what the actual biological condition is. I know I've interviewed Kelly Brogan, another former psychiatrist, and she calls these psychiatric pretenders, these biological real illnesses that produce symptoms that could easily qualify as a mental disorder.
Oh my God, there was a horrifying story in the Washington Post just last year, I believe. There was a young woman who was incarcerated in a mental hospital, and she had delusions and hallucinations. She was diagnosed with schizophrenia, and she spent 20 years in the mental hospital, and God knows what they did to her. God knows what kind of brain disabling drugs they gave her. And after 20 years, they realized she had lupus, which was causing inflammation of the brain.
Wow.
And they treated her lupus, and her psychological symptoms stopped. And she stopped 20 years back.
Yeah. Thank you for that example. It's, I mean, exactly what we're talking about. And, you know, I think that there are many people, I know that there are many people, is because I'm also a professor. I teach at a community college, and I have many, many students who have been diagnosed with ADHD, and honestly, it has kind of become, like I said, part of their self-concept, part of their identity. And so it's very uncomfortable to hear someone say, like what Dr. Saul said, that ADHD does not exist, because that gets interpreted as invalidating, or you claiming that they don't really have a problem, but they feel that there's a problem here. They are really, truly struggling. And so I would just say to anyone who's having that experience while listening, that no one is saying that you're not really struggling. We're just saying that the way that we are framing that struggle, or the way that it is framed in the DSM and in the field of psychology and kind of the mental health care in general, is erroneous. And the causes of that struggle are not what you have been led to believe. And I think that many students, for example, or anyone who is having that feeling of like, no, you don't get it, I'm really, really struggling, maybe they're in that second category that Dr. Saul was describing. And I, it's true that many people will try to exercise and sleep well and eat right and everything and not experience as much benefit as they want. But that doesn't validate that ADHD is a real thing. It just means you're likely in that second category where there are some biological, organic problems that need to be addressed. And hopefully a thorough examination and evaluation of your physical health will reveal that, just like the example you described. So yeah, I hope, because I don't know, it's interesting to be a critical thinker and a very kind person. Those don't always mesh well, and I am that type of person. You know, I'm very kind. I would never want to invalidate someone. I understand that people are truly struggling, and yet the paradigm of ADHD, which has become so deeply ingrained in our culture, is extremely problematic. So,
remember a time when children were raised on religious and national myths that placed their lives in a larger context of meaning. They read stories that taught the importance of perseverance, a little engine that could, preparation, the three little pigs, hard work, the little red hen. And today, tomes like Turbo Max, Brandon and the Bipolar Bear, and My Bipolar Roller Coaster Feelings Book teach the children the importance of psychotropic medication compliance. I think that's just one of the most egregious signs I can think of the garbage pit which our culture has descended.
I seethe inside as I think about a new generation of people being conditioned in this way to accept like the DSM as some valid source of diagnostic material and to think of drugs as the go-to treatment, just the most sensible first line of defense. I see the inside when I think about that and watch it happen. It's a crime against humanity. And as a psychologist, honestly, it irks me so deeply because, you know, this is human behavior, this is human perception, this is human cognition, this is human emotion, this is the stuff that us psychologists devote our lives to studying, and it's kind of hijacked. You know, the realm of mental health is kind of hijacked by psychiatry. So it's refreshing to talk to you and read your book, and it's very encouraging, and it does give me the sense that things are getting better. You know, when we hear people like you speaking and read the books you write, because you really lay it out well. You know, and this kind of leads me to my next question. So there's the question of the diagnosis of ADHD and whether there's any level of consistency to it, or whether it's reliable, whether, you know, the same kid would be diagnosed with the same thing from many different doctors, which we know is not the case. And so because of that, because we don't even really have a valid construct, we really can't talk about etiological explanations. You know, we can't even say what really causes it if we don't have an it clearly defined.
But there are reasons why a given child might have problems with inattention or hyperactivity. Much better identify the source of the child's distress and address that than attribute it to some mythical disease entity. Dr. Bregan once told me that most of the kids suffering from ADD, in fact, are suffering from DADD, Dad Attention Deficit Disorder.
Ooh. That's the hits. Yeah. Yeah. And that's the thing. That's kind of where I was going with that is, despite ADHD being an invalid construct with no real basis, that's not to say that children don't experience impulsivity or inattentiveness. And so we can raise the question, what contributes to inattentiveness or impulsivity? And so that is where the next lies in psychiatry is in these etiological explanations. So can you speak to us about, you know, what is presented kind of in the common culture, in the mainstream, as the cause of this ADHD construct? What is presented as the cause of it? And why is that not the case?
I've found from interacting with people on Facebook and Twitter, there are lots and lots of people there who know that this is a biologically based brain disease. And scientists know this through genetic testing or brain imaging. And this is something that to them is as indisputable as the existence of the earth and the sky. Mm. And it speaks to the ability of the pharmaceutical industry and the medical profession to crank out boxcars of disinformation whilst you and I are struggling with an armload of reason. We've had psychiatric genetics is now in its second century without a single finding benefiting a single patient in any clinic anywhere in the world. There is no gene for ADHD or any other mental illness. And we've had 45 years of neuroimaging studies. Well, counting Dr. Bradley's studies, it goes back 80 years. They haven't found, there is no difference between the ADHD brain and a quote-unquote normal brain. And yet people see, I always see articles on a regular basis in the media, how they found the gene for this or that mental illness. And they always come illustrated with these photographs of the brain, with all the different parts of the brain lit up in different colors. And I don't think one reader out of 100 knows what those photographs show. They measure blood flow through the brain. And they prove conclusively that blood flows through the brain. That's all they prove. But these pictures look so impressive that people assume there must be something to all this. Yeah. And of course, the media is heavily dependent on drug company advertising. The nightly news is brought to you by Pfizer. They tell you that up front.
True.
And it's not just that. The thing people don't understand is that drug company money means our money, my money, your money. Everybody listening to this, your money. 14% of prescription drug costs are paid for out of pocket. That means 86% are paid for by all the rest of us. We're paying through higher taxes, we're paying through higher prices, we're paying through our insurance premiums. And if you're one of America's tens of millions of benefits ineligible employees, who often are doing the same work as their benefits eligible colleagues for a fraction of their salary and no benefits, you're paying with your surplus labor. So the drug companies take our money, they use it to manufacture studies purporting to show their wares are safe and effective. They take more of our money to fund expert panels to decide who should take the drugs. They take more of our money to on the key opinion leaders who tout the drug makers' wares at professional meetings. And they take more of our money to fund advertising, to sell their wares to us. And that doesn't just pay off in terms of increased sales. It ensures a compliant media who will not say anything that will incur the displeasure of the drug companies.
What you're describing is dystopian. I mean, it's just, it's unbelievable. And I know that you've said on other interviews and that we've said on this podcast, and many people know that the US is one of two countries in the world that allows direct advertising to the citizens, to consumers. And so it is shocking, as I've heard from others who live in other countries, to come to the US and see these advertisements that are using the formulas of propaganda. They are appealing to your emotions. They are repetitive messages. They are oversimplified. And I mean, everyone knows what they are like. It's incredible how besieged we are with these commercials and advertisements. It's sickening to me. This phrase, ask your doctor if this is right for you, is a foreign concept to most other places in the world. And yet it's this mass level conditioning, making us perceive the use of drugs in children, in elderly, in everybody for long periods of time, and for anything that any human suffering is, we perceive it as normal in our culture. But it's been through propaganda that our perception has been shaped like that.
Yeah, this has become received wisdom. You have, you take aspirin. You have ADHD. You take Ritalin or Adderall.
Right.
People just, it's hard to try to get people to look at the concept, to ask the question, is there really anything you have? I mean, there's no biological cause of ADHD. It's not even a coherent syndrome. Just a box of quote unquote symptoms. It's just a list of symptoms. And the only thing they have in common is their behaviors of children that annoy adults.
Yeah, right. In contexts that are often quite stifling to children. And like, as you point out in the book, you know, you say, like, to be fair, in the DSM, it does specify that these symptoms must present in at least two different contexts. And I appreciate that the bar is at least that high and that it's not just one context. But at the same time, that doesn't add much, because still you have, like you point out, if the two contexts are school and home, and the school authorities are pressuring the parents, that they're kind of pressuring the parents to think that their child has this condition, it thwarts the parents' perception of the child. And it's all about what is the perception of the behavior. But also, it's quite possible that two contexts are both quite stifling, that a home environment can be uncomfortable or chaotic or even abusive or threatening, and that a school environment can be just way too absent of rigorous physical activity or threatening in some other way. So yeah, but let me ask you this. So if we just do away with the construct of ADHD and we are just left with this, you know, behavior or experience of impulsivity or inattentiveness, we can then ask the question, like, what contributes to inattentiveness? What contributes to impulsivity? And like you said, you can name 100 things that contribute to this. And what people are led to believe by the field of psychiatry is that there's a biological cause. As you said, either it's genetic, it runs in your family, or you have a chemical imbalance, this classic chemical imbalance myth. And that is, again, like that's, as I said earlier, that's where the next lie lies, is the etiological explanation of the symptom. And I would love to hear your take on this, especially with the biology background. And it's, so the point is that when, if a person were to examine the brain of an individual who exhibited hyper, you know, or impulsivity, and found something that deviates from a so-called neurotypical brain, most people would interpret that finding as this, we have identified the cause of the impulsivity, without considering the possibility that the impulsivity might have caused the brain to undergo changes that then get identified on a brain scan, but that the impulsivity might be due to, let's say, the home environment, the family system, or other factors. So I'm curious to hear like any reflections you have on that, just as far as like the relationship between behavior and the brain, and trying to pin down, you know, contributing factors.
Yeah, well, we all know experience changes the brain.
Right.
That's the point of having a brain. So if they ever did find some feature, brain structure or function, which was diagnostic of ADHD, that might just mean reflect common experiences associated with that label.
Exactly.
They've had decades of research. They've spent billions of dollars. And they haven't found anything. And certainly, casually reading the news media, you would think otherwise, but they haven't found anything for ADHD or any of the other functional disorders,
right,
by psychiatrists. But here's my modest proposal. We now spend $20 billion a year drugging children and increasingly adults for something called ADHD. For that kind of outlay, we could pay the mid-career salaries of an extra 350,000 teachers or 800,000 teachers' aides. Let's try that. And if we don't see a huge improvement in 5 years, I'll shut it up and never say another thing on the matter again.
Yeah, I know where I'd place my bet if that experiment were to happen. Yeah, exactly. And the horrible implication of this misunderstanding, like you said, if we ever did find a consistent biomarker, especially in brain activity or brain structure, that wouldn't necessarily determine that that is the cause of it. It could be rather that that is essentially a neural correlate, a biological reflection of something that is happening in the individual. And that what, and so let's imagine that all children with, who have been abused, experience inattentiveness. We're not just imagining this. We know that this is a strong, common effect of child abuse, is inattentiveness. And it's just common sense. Plus there's plenty of data to support that. And then let's say we find in all of these kids exhibiting inattentiveness some abnormality in some dopaminergic system or some brain structure. The problem with mistaking that brain abnormality as the cause is that you would then fail to address the real cause in your treatment protocol. Because, of course, the proper treatment for a child who is inattentive due to being abused is to stop the abuse. But if you mistake any kind of brain activity abnormality for being the cause of it, then you'll just drug their brain and the abuse will continue. The real cause stays in place. And that is one of the great tragedies of this, you know, erroneous paradigm.
Yeah, and another problem with this emphasis on brains and genes is it diverts attention away from the social factors, mm-hmm, that cause people feel distracted, impulsive, depressed, anxious,
confused,
wrathful. And it encourages a kind of political quietism. It's good for the status quo. The system is just fine. The only problem is all these people here, those defective brains. But as long as they're given the right drugs, they'll be fine. And you can't find any relevant public health outcome that has gotten better as consumption of these drugs has skyrocketed. But still, I'll believe that.
Right. It's a great point. And it makes me think how much more could you be gaslighting somebody to make them think that there's something wrong with them when there's something wrong with the world that they live in? It's just so, it's such a violation, in my opinion, to the individual's dignity. And as one more comment, maybe my last comment on some of the problems that can arise from an ADHD diagnosis is what I kind of quickly mentioned earlier, and that is, you know, the fixed mindset. And there are, in fact, it's funny, I was just in conversation with a student today who shared with me like a perfect example of what I'm getting at, which is that his friend was experiencing just high levels of distractibility and was working really hard to try to improve that. He was like cutting down his screen time. He was trying to sleep better. He was taking all these measures to improve that. But then he was diagnosed with ADHD and he just gave up on all of that because he figured, well, oh, that's why I'm distractible, because I have this condition. So why even try to fix it? It's just what I have. It's the nature of my brain. And I think that that interpretation of a diagnosis is extremely common, and it makes its way into a person's self-concept and makes them believe that this is just how my brain works.
Yeah, when I was watching my book, Dr. Healy told me a wonderful story about a patient of his. This young man was bright, personable. He had big ideas. He knew how to get people excited about his ideas. And he dreamed of becoming an entrepreneur. Well, great. But somehow he got into his head the idea that the way to do that is to go to university and major in business and get a job at a giant corporation and work your way up the career ladder. That's not entrepreneurship. That's the opposite of entrepreneurship. But he went to university and studied business and found he was spending most of his time doing spreadsheets, a task that bored him and failed to inspire him. And he got diagnosed with ADHD and got the drugs, and he managed to finish his degree. And he graduated and got a job at a giant corporation doing more spreadsheets. That's not the way. I mean, life is all about learning to maximize your strengths and manage your weaknesses. And notice I said manage, not cure. I mean, spend your time doing something you're good at instead of trying to get good at something you're bad at.
I mean, it's a good point. And a great example, you know, of just the way that I think you mentioned this in the book too, to be living a life and that feels purposeless, aimless, directionless, meaningless is inevitably going to produce some type of suffering or symptoms, I suppose you could say, that would definitely qualify as a disorder. And the thought that somebody who is experiencing purposelessness would be diagnosed with a disorder and then prescribed a drug to numb them to the feeling of purposelessness or despair, depression, or however it manifests, it's just, it's terrible, because it's the paradigm of how we think about emotions. And so to think that the emotion that would come with meaninglessness needs to be numbed is a misunderstanding of that emotion, because that emotion is an extremely important signal that is indicating that something's not right, that passion is not being felt or pursued. And so what would happen if you just squashed that emotion? Well, of course, you wouldn't seek any changes and you would continue living a life that is devoid of passion and meaning. And then what? Like, just go on through the years like that? It would just get worse. So I appreciate that story. And okay, so where I'd love to go from here is in talking about the substances that are used for this condition. So can you just kind of explain what are some of the most common drugs that are prescribed, and what is the nature of these drugs, and what are their effects?
Yes, I talked about Dr. Bradley's work with amphetamine, the Brad children of the Bradley home. Amphetamine is the same drug which is known colloquially as speed. It's not a similar drug. It's the same drug. The same drug. And in the 1950s, Ritalin was introduced, methylphenidate, a trade name Ritalin. And that's a chemical, that's a substance similar chemically to speed, does more or less the same thing to the human body. And for a while there, Ritalin almost completely eclipsed everything else prescribed for this condition. But now it's about 60% amphetamine and 40% Ritalin. And these drugs, as I said, they blunt the affect. They increase your ability to concentrate on boring tasks. They also, these are stimulants. I mean, I'm so old, I can remember back when even the hippies knew speed kills. They cause mania in susceptible individuals. Something like 1 out of 4 children treated for ADHD will go on to be diagnosed with bipolar disorder. And this is just a horrible, life-destroying condition. Dr. Healy referred to Adderall and Ritalin as, he referred to ADHD as a gateway diagnosis, just as drugs like marijuana are said, rightly or wrongly, to be the gateway to harder drugs. ADHD is a gateway to more serious diagnoses. And bipolar disorder was extremely rare in adults and unheard of in children until we began dosing large numbers of children and adults with stimulants and antidepressants. And it's showing up in precisely the children and adults that are given these dangerous drugs. And the psychiatric profession readily acknowledges that. And their party line is these drugs unmask a pre-existing disorder. Well, even if that were true, wouldn't it be better to leave it masked? Mm. Yeah, in my book, I told the story of Rebecca Riley. This was a child who had the deck stacked from her against her from the beginning. She was born into a cesspit of dysfunction, the whole family. These parents, they were probably unfit to take care of a pet turtle, let alone a child, let alone 3 of them. And the 2 older children, they'd already been diagnosed with, I think, bipolar disorder, and they get SSI payments. And so Rebecca Riley was diagnosed with ADHD at the age of 2. And she was prescribed clonidine. And at the age of 3, she was diagnosed with bipolar disorder. And the doctor continued the clonidine and also prescribed, I believe it was Seroquel and Zyprexa, if I'm not mistaken. And at the age of 4, she died. A direct result of the drug she'd been given. And the parents both were convicted of murder. And the psychiatrist who prescribed these drugs was given immunity for testifying against the parents. And she continued to practice. Kayoko Kifuji was her name.
I looked her up, actually, and sure enough, still practicing. I would love to reach out to her and speak with her, listen to her, and try to justify those prescribing practices. I mean, just how, I don't know what the right word is, ignorant, confused must you be to look at a two-year-old and diagnose them with ADHD? It's just shocking to me. And then to prescribe not just one drug, but to practice polypharmacy on a toddler. This is what I mean when I say a crime against humanity. And when I say that, I'm well aware that there may be parents listening who have consented to their child taking a certain drug. And I do think that as parents, we are responsible for educating ourselves about anything our child ingests, even if it is prescribed from a doctor who is perceived to be an expert. But I would say that the onus and the responsibility really lies on the prescribing physician. And the fact that not only are psychiatrists the ones prescribing these, but family physicians and really any medical doctor can diagnose and prescribe anyone with a psychiatric drug is part of the problem here. You know, I've read different numbers, but I've read that the majority of psychiatric drugs at this point are being prescribed by family physicians and other types of doctors. And I would already say that psychiatrists are really, in my humble opinion, not qualified to make expert assessments of the reasons that a person's behavior has become disruptive or problematic. But they're at least a little closer than doctors whose expertise is in entirely physical illnesses. So I guess I just want to say, like, to any parents listening whose toddler, whose child, or whose minor has been, you know, using prescription drugs, I understand. I can only imagine the desperation that would come if your child is just behaving in uncontrollable ways and causing intense stress in the household. I am very sympathetic to that. But I would also say that I believe you've been misled by people who purport to be experts on the matter, and that we would never consider giving our children alcohol, letting our kids smoke weed, letting our kids use cocaine, methamphetamine, heroin, speed, fentanyl, any street drug. We are appalled at the thought of someone giving our child a street drug, but that is not different than giving our child a prescribed drug. It is only different in that the prescribed drugs are pure and carefully dosed. But as far as, like you said, Dr. Han, the active ingredient, the nature of the substance, the divide between the legal and illegal psychoactive substances is illusory.
Yeah, well, you know what the party line is for psychiatry when people want to look at psychological and familial factors. They're blaming the parents, as if what the parents do has no effect on the child, do or don't do, has no effect on the child. And that view just goes against common sense so much, I'm just shocked that anybody takes it seriously. But I can see why. I mean, parental authority is so sadly eroded these days. I can see how that could be a seductive. It's not your fault, because some parents feel powerless to do anything about their children's behavioral problems. Anyway, it's not your fault. We have pills for it. You know, and as for blaming the parents, if a coach tells a tennis player, you're hitting that shot wrong, is he blaming the tennis player? Well, I guess he is, isn't he? But I don't know how to get better at anything without first taking a look at what you're doing wrong.
Yeah.
And there are ways of conveying that without demeaning the other person as a human being. That's called tact. I would hope somebody who chooses to make a living as a therapist would have at least the average amount of tact. And if right. the therapist doesn't, you could always get a new therapist.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And I just want to pause and say, like, some of the anecdotal stories that you share in this book, Rebecca Riley, I mean, it's just, I cried as I read it, especially as the father of a 2-year-old girl. And many of the other stories too, of children whose lives were ruined by these drugs. It's just, it's so heart-wrenching and necessary to expose ourselves to these stories to have a clear perception of how extreme the problem has become. Let me ask you this, and I'll just slight preamble as I lead into the question. You know, when a person examines the DSM-5, you see some disorders that, you know, I wouldn't say that they're all as inconsistent, like not all of them are equally ridiculous. You know, some at least have existed for longer, I think, describe a profile of behavior that might be a little more recognizable. Yet, it's questionable whether even the most long-standing disorders in that have been there since the DSM-1 have any real legitimacy to them. But then some of them are just almost as if it's a joke, like it's as if it's satirical. And some examples of that include disinhibited social engagement disorder, but also social anxiety disorder. So here, what we've done here in the DSM-5 is said, if you're too nervous socially, that's a disorder. If you're not nervous enough socially, that's a disorder. Intermittent explosive disorder is another. IED, as if it's like an improvised explosive device. I almost wonder, like, was someone chuckling to themselves as they made that acronym? Conduct disorder, binge eating disorder, premenstrual dysphoria disorder. There's even at the back of the DSM-5, they list disorders to consider or potential conditions to consider for the next DSM, which will probably be 5.1. And one of those is internet gaming disorder. You know, talk about naming a condition by its symptoms. It's just, that's like saying cough disorder. It's just completely absurd. And I'll kind of maybe actually reveal publicly for the first time here in conversation with you on this podcast episode that I've been working on a project, and I hope to complete it in this year of 2024, that I'm calling the Diagnostics Satirical Manual, where I am making up a bunch of almost scientific sounding conditions that are totally phony as commentary on the scientific emptiness and the lack of validity that the conditions in the real DSM have. So that's my, like I said, my preamble as I kind of lead into the question. And the question is, what made you want to title the book with the word obedience? And what is the significance of highlighting the way that these pills turn someone into a more obedient person?
Yeah, to tell the truth, that was Bill James' idea. He's another half of Samizdat Health Writers Cooperative, David Healy. I originally wanted to call it drugging them into submission, but I like Bill's better. Yeah, I mean, that's obviously the hoped for result. And as I've said, in the short run, there's hundreds of studies that show these drugs are effective. Of course, the word effective is as non-specific as an adjective can get. It means the drug has effect.
Right.
So of course it has effect. If it didn't have an effect, it wouldn't be a drug.
Right.
So specifically, there's hundreds of studies that show in the short run, these drugs blunt the affect. They increase your ability to concentrate on boring tasks. And in short, as I said, they create the same kind of changes in children that an exhausted school teacher, an exhausted parent might regard as an improvement. That's in the short term. In the long term, they've never demonstrated any benefits. The only long-term effect they've been able to demonstrate is that the drugs stunt the kids' growth and they don't catch up. And so obedience pills is the hoped for result, but that's not the reality. And as we noted, in some cases, this kicks kids into full-blown mania.
Right.
And even if that was the result, that would be dystopian. To turn a bunch of children into obedient little kids who never stand up to authority, who never express themselves, who never trust their own instincts about when something is unjust, who never call for change, who never disrupt systems. That's dystopian. And the comment that you just made about drugs having an effect is so important, you know, and I find myself saying that. I've said that on multiple episodes on this podcast, but honestly, whenever I see any kind of experiment that demonstrates these types of effects that you describe, increased focus or whatever it may be, blunted affects, I'm not impressed at all. In the same way that I'm not impressed if cocaine makes a person more focused or talkative. I've you know, this is kind of a strange thing to say, but, you know, I teach in college classrooms and I also teach in jail settings. I teach in prisons and in county jails. And many people, especially in the county jails that I work with, have had long standing drug addictions. And, you know, so I get kind of an insider's view of, you know, especially like methamphetamine, heroin, cocaine, ecstasy, but the most common one, honestly, is methamphetamine. And people tell me all the time, they describe to me what the effects of it are. And to be frank, there have been times when I've been working with a group of people who is under the influence of methamphetamine because it was snuck into the jail. And they still came to class and I witnessed, you know, and I really, no one in my social sphere is a methamphetamine user. So I didn't know exactly like what it appeared to look like when a person was under the influence. But now I've gotten a good look at that after spending hours with people who are under the influence or who can just describe it in vivid detail. And if you were to run an experiment and ask the question, you know, does methamphetamine improve a student's participation in a class or in a class discussion? The results, the conclusion would be a resounding yes. And if the goal was strictly to increase student focus and participation in a class, you should, you know, you would prescribe methamphetamine to everybody. But that's not impressive to me at all. Of course, it's a psychoactive substance. Like you said, drugs have effects and many effects of drugs are desirable, which is why people want to use drugs often, because they come with desirable effects. And whether they are synthesized in a lab or someone's trailer or they grow organically, if it's a psychoactive substance, it will exert effects on brain activity. And there's nothing all that impressive about that. And when you weigh that against the iatrogenic harm, which in case anyone is not aware of that term, an iatrogenic harm or iatrogenic just means a drug-induced effect. And so when we see whether it's sexual dysfunction or emotional instability or lethargy or hyperfixation or what's another iatrogenic harm? I mean, all kinds of physical issues, tics, tardive dyskinesia, the list goes on and on and on. And when you weigh these desired effects against the undesirable effects, especially over time, the undesirable effects are always much more significant than the desirable effects. So, please. No, go ahead.
Subject. To any young people listening to this, if you're wondering if popping your dorm mate's Adderall will get you higher grades, the answer to that question is a big, fat no. Every study done shows that the misuse of stimulant drugs results in lower grade point averages.
But yeah, it's not surprising to me because it essentially puts you on a spiral of addiction, the downward spiral of addiction.
Yeah, if being a better person is a matter of taking the right pills, then everything I think I know about being human must be wrong. But that can't possibly be the case. If there were a pill you could swallow that would make you a better person, we wouldn't be sitting here discussing it. We would all be taking the pill. There is no way you could keep something like that a secret.
Right. But that's not how life works, is it? It's not how we become better people. Well, maybe as we begin to come to a close here, what would you say to a person maybe who has been diagnosed with ADHD? Or who would be diagnosed with the ADHD if they were to see a professional who's experiencing some degree of inattentiveness or impulsivity? What guidance might you offer that person if they wanted to avoid a diagnosis and a drug prescription?
I would urge that person to spend some time in open and honest consultation with himself or herself and try to find out, why isn't there anything in your life that you feel is worth paying attention to? And then take concrete steps to remedy that situation.
Like that. And then I might just add to, just kind of emphasizing again, what I read earlier from Dr. Saul, that you put in your book, the truth is,
go.
Exactly. You know, like if you are genuinely putting forth effort to hone the faculty of concentration and executive control over impulses and finding that your efforts are not yielding results, then that is a sign that there's probably something biological and organic and an actual physical condition underlying this symptom. And certainly don't accept ADHD as your explanation, because as we've laid out, it doesn't explain anything. But have a full evaluation, and hopefully you can identify a real biological cause if there is one. And if not, then I do think it's important to understand that it's not easy to not be impulsive. It's not easy to have high levels of focus. These are skills that develop over time. And maybe certainly for some people, it comes more naturally. And for some people, it is much more of a struggle, in the same way that some people are naturally physically stronger than others. But even people who are not naturally physically strong, if they hit the weight room, they're going to get really, really strong. And so even people for whom impulsivity has maybe is just kind of a personality trait and inattentiveness has always been a struggle, that does not mean that you can't improve from your baseline. And so whether it is through practices of meditation or whatever else works, it can improve and it will improve if you put forth effort. And it's funny to think that that statement that I just said could be perceived as controversial, because I think it could be. Like, some people will feel like if I say that you could put effort into honing your power of concentration, that I'm implying that it's your fault that you have, that you're inattentive. And I'm not necessarily saying that, but I am saying that there is an internal locus of control here. You are not completely a victim of the way your mind works. There is some voluntary control that you can exercise. And I would hope that that doesn't sound controversial, rather that it sounds empowering to remember that we can consciously cultivate the faculties of our mind, but that it takes time and effort and good strategies.
Become what you practice.
Yes.
It's ancient times, and we're in the process of forgetting that.
Well, I've enjoyed this conversation very much. I certainly found myself honestly talking more than I usually do. I usually just ask questions, listen, offer a little bit of commentary. So I just want to thank you also for listening to my take on things, even though I invited you as a guest on this podcast. And everything you said has been invaluable, and your book is fantastic. So I'll remind people that it's called Obedience Pills, ADHD and the Medicalization of Childhood, available on your website and on Amazon and many places, I would imagine. So thank you so much for your contribution to this important conversation.
Thank you.
And to the Psychology is audience, I'm so glad that this kept your attention, and I look forward to being with you in the next episode.